For the question and answer period, it would be easiest if the speakers made sure they spoke directly into the mics because we're recording everything. And there is a handheld mic that Carl will pass around. So if there are questions, please raise your hand and we'll start. The gentleman here. Can you wait just for the mic?
I'd like to ask Meyer about the Liberator and who subscribed to it and how it was distributed by mail for weekly in those days.
Is this work? Yes, yeah, sorry. Liberator, yes, it went by mail, even within Eastern Massachusetts, I think. But the mail was better then, in some ways. It was shipped on coastal boats down to New York, Philadelphia, and there was a large distribution network. Garrison printed somewhere between, as far as I can figure, 2,000 and 4,000 copies a week. But I think the circulation is much larger than the numbers, because this is the kind of thing that was passed around a great deal. There were reading rooms where it was put. I have some evidence about it being read aloud in barbershops. Barbershops particularly were focal points in the free black community, and barbering was a trade that was open to black people, and so a number of white people heard about the Liberator while they were in their black barbershop. And several abolitionists have talked about this. Particularly in the early days, black political societies and churches had what were called agents of the Liberator, and they were listed on the masthead, and they took subscriptions, and they made sure the things got delivered. Later on, the circulation became more general, the way a lot of religious papers were circulated. The numbers didn't change very much. He printed a lot of free copies that he mailed to congressmen, clergymen, and so on. I saw in the Liberator subscription books, at one point, one of the things I do is I trace the gradual progress of the Liberator across the continent as civil. And the first Liberator in San Francisco, there's a subscriber in San Francisco in 1849. Think about it, going around the horn, you know, all this. Somebody gave, William Herndon, Lincoln's law partner, was in Boston, and he called on Garrison, and they had a grand old talk. And I think there's a certain back channel of communication between some of the Illinois radically disposed Republicans and Garrisonians. And Herndon took out a subscription to the Liberator, so Lincoln is the only presidential candidate we know of that actually had a subscription coming into his office. That doesn't mean he read it. Somebody gave Lincoln a gift subscription when he was in the White House, and they were so provoked with his dilatoriness on emancipation that they actually canceled the gift subscription in August 1862, just as he actually was moving toward, they gave up a few weeks too soon.
In reading Law on Fire, which I think is a wonderful book, questions keep coming to my mind. Hold the microphone horizontally. Questions keep coming to my mind in terms of comparisons of what Garrison was going through and the contemporary libertarian movement. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts in terms of parallels, in terms of obstacles in both cases, and also prescriptions for overcoming the obstacles. And I'd be interested in both your comments on that.
As Michael's setting me up with this question, because he knows that the November issue of Liberty has a review that I co-authored with Diane Peterson of All on Fire, in which I try to draw out some lessons for the libertarian movement. And the most important lesson that I think Garrison brings home to me is it relates to this debate between moralism and consequentialism. That's the way Bradford has framed the debate. And in one sense, this is the argument: do you use moral arguments or do you use consequential arguments to convince people of your position? And in one sense, I think the argument is a false dichotomy because you should use both. However, I think that what has happened with the libertarian movement overall is that there was a greater emphasis when we were all young radicals on the moral argument, and we became discouraged because they didn't immediately bring about the political successes that we thought they might. And so there's been less and less emphasis on that, and greater emphasis on pragmatic and practical argument. And I don't want to denigrate any of the important work on, you know, the economic consequences of antitrust laws or all of these pragmatic arguments. But I think that libertarians hadn't realized the extent to which they'd actually won the moral argument. In other words, when you compare government taxation to theft, and you make that moral argument, you know, you don't morally think theft is justified, well then why is taxation justified? That's a powerful argument that I think almost no one fails to understand. And I think that it should be continued to be made. In other words, in some respects, we're in the same position as Garrison, who is appealing to shared moral ideals, but demanding that people achieve a higher standard of consistency in applying those ideas. So I think there are an awful lot of lessons. And I'll leave it at that. You tell it to go on and on.
Why don't we have another question, and I'll work in. No. Well, all right. But I would say my answer would be, look at the length of his career and hang on. We're all abolitionists now. All movements are destined to be misunderstood and marginalized while they are making cutting arguments. And the other thing is to be prepared for the unexpected. You see what a turn the moral agitation of slavery took. I'll say more.
I want to continue this same discussion because I think, from my perspective, one of the problems we have is we don't have in libertarianism at this time a fireball like Garrison or Thomas Paine. And the ones that we do have that tend to that direction, also if you read their writings, they're kind of lunatic. I mean, there's one guy over in Las Vegas who he sounds like a fireball libertarian. But when you get down to read what he says, he thinks AIDS isn't caused by HIV, and everybody ought to be able to own SAM missiles. Now, you know, it gets to the point you're not going to convince anybody of this kind of nonsense. In a way, it seems like what we need is...
Do you have a question?
Well, it's a comment. My comment is, we need the fireballs, but we need somebody who stays within rationality. And it sounds to me like Garrison did that. Is that true? Or was he indeed also off the deep end in a whole lot of areas?
Depends on who you ask.
No, somebody who looks at it in retrospect with some kind of logic.
Well, but you raise a very important question. I mean, you raised it earlier in your remarks. And that's this: how many causes can a movement advocate simultaneously? And the argument between being practical because you don't want to alienate people and being pure so that you express your vision fully is a political tension and intellectual tension in every kind of movement. So I wasn't joking, because you see, some people admired Garrison for his universality. other people thought he was a lunatic for raising other crazy issues such as pacifism and such as women's rights. That these were too forbidden, too provocative. You will scare people away. And in fact, he and I didn't go into this at all because it's a little like inside the Beltway politics at this point, but you know, he was extremely vilified by clergymen who should have been his allies because they feared his power as a rival spiritual leader and because they feared that they would be tagged with all of what Garrison used to call his budget of heresies, by which, you know, his list of extraneous issues. And the issue of extraneous issues is what split the abolition movement. I mean, explicitly it was women's rights, and the role of women in the movement, but implicitly it's the sort of one cause versus one issue versus many. And I think you know, movements are very diverse things and very diffuse things, so it's hard to control people. And it is one of the problems is you spend a lot of time apologizing for people you don't agree with, and that's just part of it.
One thing, one thing I might mention as an aside is that we publish a book called Freedom, Feminism, and the State, which is a book on the subject of the Grimke's sisters and others who came out of the abolitionist movement, which were essentially the originators of women's liberation. There's also a new book that Wendy McElroy is putting together for us now, which will extend this for women into the 21st century. Anyway, another question. About the gentleman
Although they were colleagues for many years, you mentioned in the autograph signing that Frederick Douglass and Garrison had a falling out. I wonder how that came about.
Well, let me describe a little bit about their relationship in the good days. When Frederick Douglass escaped from slavery and came north, he pretty soon found, he said that the Liberator was one of his great inspirations. He pretty soon found his way into the anti-slavery conventions, and this underscores what Jeff was saying about the sort of salience of the fugitive slave issue. The fugitive slave, an escaped slave, was a very powerful moral statement and a very powerful stimulus to thought anytime an escaped slave spoke. And Douglass from the beginning spoke with great authority. And Garrison and others in the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society hired him as a lecturer, as a paid lecturer. And one of the collateral, this is an issue, this is an instance of how issues get raised, integrated travel was very difficult. And so the abolitionists perforce became desegregationists and became embattled in all sorts of fights on railroad trains and steamboats, just going to and fro in their business so long as they were, when they traveled in a mixed race situation, which they made a point of doing because they were trying to expose Northern prejudice as part of the problem. Douglass and Garrison were close through the entire 1840s. Douglass was a Garrisonian. He was a non-resistant. He believed in disunion and this whole application of soul force. And then in the 1850s, Douglass had a political shift. Douglass is a complicated figure. He was torn between, within his own sense of himself, he was a work in progress at this point, as to whether he wanted to be a leader or a black leader. And he was in some certain degree forced to become a black leader by virtue of what his experience was, but it was something that he did not, he was a powerful intellect, he didn't particularly want to be boxed in. He ran a newspaper of his own. There was a certain amount of rivalry with Garrison on this. I think the situation is that he's a protege who outgrew and to a certain degree had to disagree with his mentor. It's tempting, and a lot of people have said that the break with Garrison is a product of racism, and that Garrison was trying to hold Douglas down. I don't see it that way. I don't really see much evidence for that. I think that Douglas was charting an independent position, I think. And I think Garrison ultimately respected that, but it got very ugly and very personal for a while, as most intra-movement fights do. They did compose their differences by the time of the war, but they were never again as close. But they were very close. They traveled together. They traveled to England together. They traveled or stoned together in Ohio, and so on. So they were real. They were. Yeah, right. Sorry, they were victims of stonings. See, you live so totally in this 19th century world, you forget. But anyway, I think that this was a much more of a younger, older protege issue than it was a racial issue. I think it's a false way of looking at it.
Gentlemen. Thank you. Is this working?
Okay.
I'm good at ducking loud.
I figured out you're recording this. It's not that you're amplifying.
Right. Right.
So we can hear you. You just need to talk
right,
so they
fine.
Can get
right.
Out
of there. Well, my question is, Professor Mayer mentioned or described the story of Garrison's burning of the Constitution on the grounds of, slavery was constitutional, so much worse for the Constitution. What I'm curious about is I know that some of the abolitionists argue that slavery was unconstitutional, such as Lysander Spooner, and I would like to hear the opinion of our two speakers on that subject. Do you think that that's a good argument, that slavery was unconstitutional?
Okay. It depends on what you mean by a good argument. I have extreme reservations about constitutional arguments in general, because I think that not just libertarians but many others sort of think of constitutional arguments as substitute for policy arguments. You know, they want to Second Amendment questions are a good example of this. You know, if we convince everybody of the original intent of the Second Amendment, and I buy all of those arguments, then we will win the gun control debate. And I think that if you look at most people in the world today, and if you look at figures historically, the policy arguments are the dog wagging the constitutional tail. It's very rare to find a person who is says, well, this is a good policy, but I'm not going to support it because it's unconstitutional. In other words, usually what they do is they decide what they think is a good constitutional policy, and then end up coming up with constitutional justification one way or the other. So I think of it as a kind of a meta-argument to drain resources. The Constitution was initially deliberately designed to be ambiguous in order to get it passed. And so there are going to be a lot of these open issues. But on the question of whether the Constitution was pro-slavery or anti-slavery, if you're asking the question of original intent, it's clearly a pro-slavery document, without any doubt. It's a commonplace that special interests have come to dominate government. Well, special interests have always dominated government. It's just less objectionable when government is small and intrusive. And one of the most important special interests in American history from the adoption of the Constitution until the Civil War was what abolitionists and Republicans called the slave power, which, even though only a minority within the South itself, dominated politics in the South and dominated politics at the national level. And I think the Constitution had many concessions to the slave power. Now, I know that Spooner was using a kind of Richard Epstein, let's look at the text, ignore the intent of the founders kind of argument. You know, the words should speak for themselves. And I think that's an interesting intellectual exercise, and if it convinces anybody, all the better. And it may lay the groundwork, and it may lay the groundwork for future political changes when the underlying climate of opinion has changed. But I don't think that that kind of argument persuaded anyone about slavery.
I don't really have much to add to that. I agree with it. But I'll go away from Spooner and talk about the Liberty Party people, and that's kind of where Douglas had gone. I think there's a lot of wishful thinking in their reading of the Constitution. I think Garrison was much closer to the mark in understanding the pro-slavery intent. And had the Liberty Party people come into office on their platform, they would have been, their hands would have been tied. There was no way that under the actual practice of the Constitution they could have taken any more steps than the Republicans would have taken in 1860. Could I ask you a question while we're on this point? I think one of the paradoxes here is that you have the South in 1860 saying, we have to leave because all is lost under the Constitution because a sectional president has been elected that we don't own. And the abolitionists feel, and so they're saying, you know, Lincoln, we're leaving because Lincoln's going to do too much. The abolitionists are sitting there wringing their hands because they think Lincoln's going to do nothing. The Republicans have been elected on a platform of containing slavery in the existing states and not letting it spread. And they're even willing at the end of 1860 to endorse another 13th Amendment, not the one we have, but one that died in the war along with all the people, that would have permanently guaranteed slavery in those states and would have been an unamendable amendment. And so the interesting question is, why did the South go at that particular moment?
They want to answer the question.
You don't
No. I'll answer that. I think the South seceded over the issue of slavery. I think that's the underlying reason that they seceded. The paradox that arises is that if my argument is correct, is that letting them go in peace is a way of bringing down slavery, then why are they going for this option? And the answer, I have two parts to the answer. One is that the Southerners who initially support secession see that it's a desperate gamble on that part. In other words, you've got some Southerners proposing that, we can set up a kind of border patrol or reverse Berlin Wall that prevents abolitionists from coming down and slaves escaping. Because remember now, the slave power has dominated the national government, and then all of a sudden in 1860 someone's elected who not only doesn't carry a single slave state, but in many of them doesn't get a single recorded vote. And it's a desperate gamble on their part. But there are also many Southerners, including Alexander Stephens, who becomes Confederate Vice President, who oppose secession. And Stephens' argument was that despite Lincoln's election, slavery is still safer in the Union than outside of the Union. And initially, secession only passes by overwhelming majority in South Carolina. It passes by very small majorities in the other Gulf Coast states. And it fails in Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Arkansas. The further polarization of the issue and what drives many wavering Southerners into a secessionist revolution is, of course, the firing on Fort Sumter, followed by Lincoln calling out of troops. And once it becomes clear that Lincoln will not accept the notion of a voluntary union, that he's going to hold together the Union by force, then the secessionist revolution gets a second wave of momentum. So it's a complex interplay of many different factors, but I think slavery is the underlying explanation.
Let me get some people in the front here.
One topic that hasn't been raised yet is military conscription, specifically its history prior to the Civil War, its role in the Civil War, and whether the abolitionists, including Garrison, had any public position on it.
Well, actually, you're very clear. The exposition, this is as good a time as any for me to say how much I admire not only Jeff's narrative, which compresses an awful lot into short chapters, but I had my first history professor said his first law, Taylor's first law, was read the footnotes. In this case, the law is amended. The corollary is read those bibliographic essays. Don't skip them, because there are so many interesting and provocative ideas for many more books in there that they really are worth your time. It's very, very exciting. And Jeff's description of conscription and the draft is one of the better ones. So ideally, he should give you the general answer, and I should tell you about Garrison, but my answer is short. Garrison was a non-resistant. Garrison never voted because he did not want to support the war-making powers of the Constitution. Garrison had three sons old enough for military service. Two became conscientious objectors. One of the two paid the commutation fine, and he'll explain what that's all about. And one served. And the one who served did so after long and sort of prayerful consideration in the family, and he served as an officer in the 55th Massachusetts Volunteer Regiment, which was the second black regiment formed from the overflow of volunteers for Robert Shaw's regiment. And he survived.
The Civil War brought nationally administered conscription to the United States. Now, I'm not going to go into all the details. You can read the book. But there is a popular misunderstanding. Many people believe that, in fact, the American Revolution was fought exclusively with volunteers, that the War of 1812 was fought exclusively with the volunteers. Wrong. It turns out that traditionally the militia system is a decentralized system of universal military training and conscription. So in the colonial period and early national period, whenever you hear the phrase calling out the militia, what's happening there is that each militia district is getting a quota. If they manage to meet the quotas with volunteers, that's fine. But if volunteers fail to fill the quota, then they conscript from the militia role. Now, it wasn't as onerous as modern conscription, because you could pay a fine to get out of it, or you could hire a substitute. But nonetheless, there was massive conscription during the American Revolution, and massive conscription during the War of 1812. And in fact, most of you know about the Whiskey Rebellion, opposition to Alexander Hamilton's tax. Well, the army, the derisively named Watermelon Army, that suppressed the Whiskey Rebellion was actually partially filled with militia conscripts. What happens is that during the Jacksonian era at the state level, you have a militia reform movement that in most of the northern states not only voluntarizes the militia, but practically privatizes the militia. And thus the Mexican War becomes the first war in American history to be fought entirely and exclusively with volunteers. This militia reform movement doesn't get formally as far in the South because the militia is too closely tied with the compulsory slave control system in the slave states, which every slave state had. Nonetheless, even in the South where you still have compulsory militia on the books, there is a movement towards a volunteer militia system so that at the outset of the Civil War, both sides are filling the armies with volunteers. And it turns out to be one of the most astonishingly rapid military mobilizations in history. We all know that people are enthusiastic about wars when they start. Eventually, the enthusiasm wanes, and so both the Confederacy and the Union ultimately resort to conscription, the Confederacy first, the Union next. And although this is not the first conscription in American history, nor is it even the first conscription at the behest of the national government, it does represent the first system of centrally administered conscription. In other words, where there is a body at the federal level, both in the Confederacy and a bureaucracy in the Confederacy and the Union that administers the system of conscription. It was much more important to the Confederacy than to the Union. The Union only managed to draw in a very small percentage of the people through recruits through conscription. And the main reason for the Confederate conscription law was not to bring new people into the army, but under Confederate conscription, no one could leave after their voluntary term expired. It was mainly designed to hold people in the military until they were either wounded, killed, or the war ended.
Okay, two more questions. How about right behind you?
Speaking of conscripts and that, what actually motivated the Northerners to enlist? I could understand if they were motivated by wanting to free the slaves, but to enlist to kill your fellow countrymen just to preserve the Union, I've never quite understand this nationalist motivation of the North. Can you, either one of you or both of you, elaborate on that?
When you say you don't understand it, do you mean you don't agree with it, or do you not actually understand it? I mean, haven't you lived through the Gulf War and the Iranian hostage crisis and observed the visceral response that first of all, very, very few Northerners, although there were some, but very few Northerners initially enlisted to end slavery. The goal was to preserve the Union. And what had happened was that by the time of the Civil War in the North, there had become this mystical identification of Union and liberty. Southerners saw Union as a means towards an end. Northerners had come to see view the Union, in other words, they immediately thought that breaking up the Union would compromise liberty without reflecting on the accuracy of that. And moreover, when you had the firing on the flag at Fort Sumter, and that's really what galvanized Northern recruits initially. While it's a sentiment that I may not share, I don't have a lot of difficulty understanding it since I see it all around me today. I would say that the main reason that Northerners initially enlisted in the war effort and the main reason that the North initially decided to prevent the South from leaving the Union was the ideology of nationalism. The identification of the nation, of people with the nation. Do you want to add anything to that?
Let's have another question, and I'll see if I can.
Wait.
Song's second to last. Then my question is specifically for Professor Helmholtz. Sir, in your book, you documented the disease and injury of Civil War servicemen inspired the growth of a private, often voluntary medical care support network. What happened to this spontaneously emerging private and decentralized medical system after the war?
Well, one thing it led to was the Red Cross, right? Clara Barton is a Civil War nurse. So to a certain extent, it does produce an enduring legacy. But of course, one of the counter thrusts of the Civil War is that after the war, you begin to see at the state level professional licensing movement. It's really after the Civil War that you get professional licensing of lawyers, and the kind that restricts entry. There had been some states that licensed doctors prior to the Civil War, but the really restrictive licensing of doctors occurred after the Civil War. And finally, by the turn of the century, the dominant ideology in the United States has become progressivism. And progressivism varied in different parts of the country, and it's different in urban areas than in agrarian areas. But the underlying motif, the unifying theme of all progressivism is that the government is the solution to the problem. I don't know whether that's fully answered.
We just have one more question.
Yes, as a longtime member of the British Anti-Slavery Society, I have to ask a question of Professor Mayer, and that is, what would Garrison say today about 747 airplanes full of American tourists flying into game-watching safaris in Kenya, while 500 miles to the north, rank slavery in Sudan exists? How about, I can go down the list, buying and selling of children in Bangladesh and in Thailand, massive existence in India and South America of indentured servitude, and the common perception of the American person in the street that slavery went with Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. What would he say?
Well, I can't answer your question in quite the way you ask it, because I pretty much made it a rule with my subjects that I wouldn't try to speak for them in the 20th century. But Garrison was a consistent voice from first to last against human slavery throughout the world. The Liberator, you know, what is the subhead underneath the Liberator? The motto? My country, well, somebody with better eyes than ours, right? That's why I'm asking you to.
Country is the world,
mankind. And so he was not simply against American slavery. He was against slavery throughout the world. That his focus was on what he considered the most heinous and in some sense the most morally embarrassing, because it was his own country, focused on the U.S. But he participated in international conferences, and were he alive, the Liberator would be full of the stuff that you're talking about. That I'm certain.
I have actually one reaction to that, which is that it is true that slavery does persist in many parts of the world, illicitly and clandestinely. And so the world has a much larger population now. It can get pretty horrifying in terms of the numbers. Yet nonetheless, we shouldn't underestimate the abolitionist triumph. Because we live in a world today where no dictator, no matter how tyrannical, no matter how vile, would get up and publicly defend chattel slavery. And remember that prior to the 18th century, slavery was a system that had been ubiquitous on every continent. Very few people challenged it. Everybody thought that it was necessary, if not desirable. Now, I think that is not only a stunning testament to the power of moral ideals, but also, in my opinion, it represents the most successful and enduring of all the triumphs of classical liberalism. You know, to take a labor system that had been in existence since the dawn of civilization and almost, not quite, but almost wipe it off the face of the earth.
I want to thank our two speakers, Henry Merritt and Jeff Hummel, for their great talks and their work. It truly is people like Henry and Jeff who are continuing the grand tradition that Garrison developed. For those of you who have not gotten copies of the books, this is your opportunity. There are copies upstairs still of both Jeff and Henry's books. And I want to thank you all for joining with us. We hope that you'll visit with us again at future events. I'm sure that both of our speakers would be happy to autograph copies if you haven't had your copies autographed already. Thank you for coming. Good night. Thank you.